We've been discussing the mission of Moshe, all the different aspects, many different aspects of it, and the fact that his initial encounter with Paro seems to have been a failure, leads to a disaster, in the sense that, and it's something which was unexpected, that is that Paro was not passive about the situation. And he didn't just refuse Moshe's request. It seems from all the commentaries that had he simply refused, that would not have been a problem for Moshe, because God had already told him that Paro would not listen to him, and that all of his negotiations would not have any effect, but eventually the Jews would be released, but that would only be with Biyad Chazaka. It would only be because of a strong hand. So, just to review, in point of fact, had Paro simply said no, then nothing would have happened. Moshe would not have been surprised. That would have been in line with what he expected. But even Moshe Rabbeinu in this situation, the fact that God was communicating with him, but as we see in many cases, doesn't mean that the prophet knows everything. Doesn't mean he's given every piece of information. He's given a certain amount of information. There was something that he didn't expect, and that was the reaction of Paro. And that is that Paro was not content to just say no. Apparently he wanted to go further and to nip it in the bud. If he sensed that this was a movement, that someone had come along to arouse the Jews out of their slumber, so to speak, and to instigate them to demand certain rights and privileges that would interfere with their labor. So Paro meant to destroy that. And he came up with a very devious scheme. And essentially the objective was to turn the people against Moshe. And he did that by increasing the labor and worsening the situation, and making it clear that the reason for doing that was because of the fact that he regarded them as being lazy. That all talk about a need to go and worship God was a result of the fact that they really want to get away from work. The whole thing is just a ruse to get away from the work. And it's because they're lazy. And if that's the case, then they have to do more work. And what he did was he removed the supply of straw. So we went through that already. That it imposed more physical labor, but the anxiety as well, because they were obliged to fill the same quota of bricks, except now they had the additional burden of going around and gathering these straw. So the situation worsened, and the officers, the Jewish officers, the shotrim, were held responsible to see to it that the Jews produced the same amount of bricks, and they weren't able to do so. Now Rashi says that they were merciful, that in order to get the Jews to work harder, they would have had to inflict suffering, to beat the Jews, but they refused to do that, and instead they took the beating themselves. That's the Chazal. Anyways, for whatever reason, apparently you see a certain attitude towards the situation. These shotrim were able to get a meeting with Paro. The Torah describes all this at length. They obtained a meeting with Paro and presented their case. It's a bit, it's almost, in a sense, it's heartrending when you read it from our perspective, because you get the sense that they are attributing some type of fairness or justice to Paro in the way they present the case. Obviously, people who present the case that way must believe to a certain extent that the individual they're talking to has some type of compassion or a certain sense of justice or fairness. But it met with complete disaster. That's when he told them that this is because of your laziness. So this was a big failure. The Chumash points out that when they left, they encountered Moshe and Aaron, and they expressed all of their hostility and frustration. That is to say that you've given Paro a sword. They say, let God see and judge. they're calling Moshe into judgment, that you made our situation much worse in the eyes of Pharaoh. You've destroyed our standing in the eyes of Pharaoh. You've given us a bad odor, is pretty much the way you could translate. Sherev Ashtem Esrechenu. You've given us a bad odor in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of his servants to put a sword in their hands to kill us. So basically, that's what they were saying.
The Shochrim was saying this to Moshe.
And then it says that Moshe returned to Hashem. And just reading his words clearly conveys the impression that there is that tone of upset. Why have you dealt evilly with this people? Why have you sent me? From the time that I came to Pharaoh to speak in your name, the situation has worsened. He's made it more evil for this people, and you haven't saved your nation. So we were trying to understand the question and the answer. Basically, we said that Moshe needed a certain amount of guidance at this point, because what happened was completely unexpected, in that it clearly had a disastrous effect on his mission. That how is he supposed to lead the Jews and bring them back to the principles of Judaism, and also that they should follow him in terms of what they would have to do. Here the issue is not so much Paro, but the Jewish people, when they're going to view him as an enemy, so to speak, as a source of a result of what he's doing is making the situation worse. So his whole credibility as a leader would clearly be undermined. And we try to understand God's answer. On the surface, God simply says, now you will see what I will do to Paro. For with a strong hand, he'll send them forth. And with a strong hand, he will drive them out from the land.
So if that's so, why did he wait?
So that's what we discussed last time. We gave certain ideas that the key word over here is now. That the events that were going to happen were intended for a purpose, as we said, for the Egyptians, as the Psukim say throughout, that the Yadu Mitzrayim Kani Et Hashem, that Egypt should learn. These were demonstrations. Egypt should recognize God. And of course, the Jews, above and beyond that, the Jews would not just recognize God, but they would go on to accept the Torah and the covenant. So certain things had to be made clear. That is, the ground had to be prepared. And we mentioned certain things. That people might say, if things started to get better right away, and so on and so forth, and looking back, people might think that the situation wasn't that bad altogether. Sometimes the situation appears one way to you. This is a very important point, and people don't learn from their experiences. Sometimes when you're facing certain difficulties, you begin to magnify them and you become paralyzed almost, and you figure you're in a hopeless situation. That's a huge problem. Very often people go through life in hopeless situations. Every situation is hopeless. And they magnify the situation and they're in a state of despair. And because of that, either they suffer, and sometimes the worst, people could do terrible things to themselves. People could even commit suicide. Many people committed suicide after the stock market crash of 1929. That's an important point, though, that many times people might even commit suicide because they're absolutely convinced of the hopelessness of a situation. But just because a situation appears to be hopeless, there's another thing that one ought to remember, and that is to say that the fact that it appears one way doesn't have to mean. You never really fully understand all the elements of a situation. And very often what happens is you're in a situation like that, and then you run to somebody for help, whatever it is, and you're absolutely convinced that nothing can save you, but people intervene and so on, and it turns out it's not so bad. I'm sure everybody's had that feeling. Everybody's had the feeling of disaster, of sheer disaster, expecting the worst. And I think everybody has had the feeling where it appeared that way, but in retrospect, it wasn't that bad. I exaggerated it. I allowed my emotions to exaggerate the situation. So that you really don't know. it's a good idea. I mean, as a general rule, it's a good idea, even if you have feelings, to not to believe those feelings. And people that survive pretty much one way or another, you see, there are people that have an ability like that, that when everybody else has given up hope or the situation looks impossible, they continue to function. And they keep searching and searching, and then very often they come up with something. They don't give in to that feeling to just give up, that it's an absolute disaster and just hide. Now, therefore, in the case of the Jews in Egypt, there's always the danger that if things would have picked up as soon as Moshe started to come and to negotiate, then I'm sure that many people would have said, yeah, it wasn't that bad to begin with. And had we organized and gone to Paro, we could have improved the situation. And they rationalize, and they also deny, well, why didn't you go? Well, we couldn't go. The time wasn't ready yet. People always are in that kind of a mode. So therefore, that's one factor, that it was necessary to demonstrate just how tough an opponent Paro was. You see from the situation itself that the Shotrim, the officers, apparently didn't view Paro as being the most evil person because they made an appeal to him. So they did ascribe a certain legitimacy to the situation. But their attitude afterwards was that this is an impossible individual. It's an impossible situation. That is to say, there's no way that any people could escape. There's no way that any slave could escape from this situation. So that was part of it. To demonstrate the utter impossibility of the situation. To the point where it wasn't that Moshe was successful, his initiative failed completely. Not only did it fail completely, it made matters even worse. So that the situation, this is supposed to be the foundation, of course, for all future generations, for the acceptance of the Torah, and teaching us the fundamental principles of Judaism, the idea of creation, creation from nothing, that God is the absolute master of the universe, that through the display of the various miracles and so forth, all of this required a certain context, that Paro was the mightiest of kings. In terms of those who maintain that there's nothing more, there's nothing higher than the physical realities that we encounter. And Moshe Rabbeinu spoke in the name of God. So those are some of the factors. We pointed out to a number of factors. I wanted to add one more thing, though, which we hadn't mentioned. In fact, that's how the Pasuk, in my opinion, should read. God says, now you will see, now. Now that the situation has reached the worst possible depths, and that it's going to be clear that there's no way that the Jews have any control over the situation, and they're up against the mightiest and most stubborn ruler, now they will see that it's with a strong hand. Because of this, they'll recognize that I'm sort of like reinterpreting the pasuk in accordance with this idea. So now it's time. Now they'll see the strong hand. Now they're ready for the strong hand. Timing is very, very important. If miracles happen at the wrong time, they don't have the desired effect. People have to be in the correct state to appreciate it. And with a strong hand, he will drive them out of the land. I wanted to mention one more thing over there, and it touches upon a very big point. One of the big issues, there's many major issues that are encompassed in these sedras that we've been doing in these areas. Major issues and major problems and questions. So I sort of want to tie this in with another major issue which comes up in the next sedra, Va'era, which is very interesting. We're going to go a little bit ahead because the dialogue between God and Moshe continues. And Moshe still, even after this, as we'll see at the beginning, we're not doing it today, but we will be doing it hopefully, Moshe still even after God's answer, and so forth, still returns to his original complaint of his impediment of speech. And that creates a big problem. That's very difficult to understand. I thought that issue was dealt with already. All right, we're not going to take that up right now. Hopefully we'll come back to it. But after some digressions at the beginning of Va'era, everything seems to... Because apparently the setback, the worst thing, had an effect upon Moshe, upon the mission, and so forth, and even upon the Jews as well. You have to assume that. So the opening, God sends a new message to Moshe at the beginning of Va'era. There's a new message. And that's the beginning of Va'era. We'll just take a look at it, so we'll sort of set the stage, even though we're not taking it up right now. But it's easy to see that in chapter 6, this is, and many learn this as a continuation of God's answer, even though it's in two different sedras. And it's simply a continuation. First God says, now you will see. And then, or you could say this is a separate message, whatever, I don't know how much significance that would have. Anyways, but that I appeared to Abraham and Isaac and Jacob with the name Kael Shakai. But with the name Hashem, I did not make myself known to them. And so on. So of course, everybody comments on this. What's the significance of the names? And indeed, we find that God did appear to the patriarchs. They did, it seems they were aware of the name of Hashem. But what's the difference anyways? These are interesting questions. We're not taking it up right now, as I said. Then it mentions that I've established my covenant with them to give them the land of that they dwelled in, the land of Canaan. And a lot of ands, vagam, and also, I've heard the moanings, the screams of the children of Israel from the enslavement, and I remembered my covenant. Therefore, go and tell the Bnei Israel, go and tell them, I am the Lord, and I shall remove you from beneath the labors of Egypt. And this is what's called the four languages, the four expressions of redemption. I will remove you. Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote about this idea. I'll remove you. V'itzalt, and I will save you from the slavery. V'ga'alti, I will redeem you with a mighty hand. V'lakachti, and I will take you. So each one of these, it's not redundant, but each one is a different connotation. The four expressions of redemption. The question I have is that wasn't Moshe given this message, albeit not as detailed, but that seems to be the original message that God gave at the burning bush, and he sent them, and God said they will listen. They will listen. Basic message was that the God of Abraham has spoken to me, and he's going to take you out, and so on and so forth. So what is the point of the second message, and so on? You know, why was it needed, and how is it different? What's its purpose, and so on? But perhaps, putting it simplistically, maybe there was a need. I'm sure the first thought that comes to mind is that after a setback, spirits are broken. They all were excited. They accepted the news when Moshe came, and then they were disappointed. That's always a difficult, difficult thing, to have the courage to go to listen to Moshe and to go to Paro, whether they all went to Paro, some Chazal say that many of them drifted away and didn't go to Paro, but whatever the case is, I am sure that the news of what Paro did, just like it bothered the Shotrim and they yelled at Moshe, so might have caused a lot of discouragement. So maybe the people needed to have another message. Don't get discouraged. But then it says, we'll go through it briefly to return to it in more depth later. And take a look at 9. And Moshe spoke this way to the Bnei Yisrael, delivered this message, below Shamuel Moshe. They did not listen to Moshe. But then it adds, Mikotzer Ruach, from a shortness of spirit, Umeavoda Kasha, and from hard labor. What does that mean? What's the pasuk telling us? The Ramban points out, you would think that they didn't listen to him, perhaps because he wasn't convincing. But that's not the case. They didn't listen to him because of the psychological state. A person, you learn something extremely important from this also. There's many secondary ideas, even though this is not necessarily the purpose of telling us this, but there's so much that we can learn from it. The Ramban says that they didn't listen to him. That was because they weren't in the appropriate mental state. That sometimes a person psychologically, he's closed. He can't entertain a certain thought. I would compare it, although it's not the exact same thing, but I think it has something sort of like a mental burnout. You see that there sometimes a person is in a state where they're open-minded. They have a big mind and they're open-minded. Doesn't mean they'll agree, but they have the ability to listen to something. Now, well, obviously, we're talking about something that requires a certain amount of open-mindedness, a certain amount of insight, a certain amount of imagination. I'm sure you all know people that if you have something you want to discuss with, some idea, which may seem at first glance to be crazy, but a wiser person will grapple with it, will think. I'm sure you know that there are certain people you don't share those kinds of things with. I guess we would call them small-minded people. Small-minded people basically reject any kind of a new thought, a new idea, a new way of doing things. They would forget about it. It's impossible. They can't see beyond the way the situation is right now. Then you have some great people, and all the great thinkers in history were, at first they were rejected, pretty much. People who have the ability to look beyond and can think big. Imagination. Now, in order for people, so what happens is that sometimes there are people who are willing to listen, and they can entertain, and they can think into it, and they can take a chance on something. But that demands a certain attitude, a certain spirit. Now, what happens to many people is there is a certain pattern that happens, and that is that when you're younger, you're dealing certain things you can only deal with young people. As people get older, they get smaller. The mind gets smaller and smaller, like frozen brain cells or something like that. In youth, when people are young, they're more apt to be fresh, innovative. And that's the way the world works, to a large extent. All the progress in the world has a lot to do with the young people, because it's an emotional thing, too. It's a psychological thing, because then you have that spirit of rebelliousness. You want to create your own identity. You want to do things differently. You have a certain sense of adventure. You want to go out there and do something, and you're not old and conservative. As you get older and older, you've already done your thing. Now you become the establishment. You want to protect what you have, and also you don't want to take chances anymore because you have a lot built up. You don't want to lose this. You don't want to lose that. And you're thinking to conserve. But there's a certain mentality. You can see with older people, like they small-minded.
They do things their way.
That's but there's also small-mindedness. A person should strive to retain that element of youth, to be mentally young. And that is that you can communicate and you can listen and you're not fixed. You're not fixed into your particular thing and that's it. Closed-minded. I'm just using that as an illustration. Obviously, the situation of the Jews over here was different. And that's because the pain that they went through, when a person goes through enough pain, if a person has gone through enough disappointment, so then he sort of becomes narrow. He can't take certain things seriously. And I do think that it sort of reinforces. Now that I think of it, it sort of reinforces what we said. That atasira, that now you will see. Because you even see the mental attitude of the Jews. That the mental attitude of the Jews was different than when Moshe first came to them. And then now they couldn't even consider the idea. They couldn't take it. They couldn't think into it. It didn't register as any kind of reality in their psyches because they were just too burned.
They were white.
They didn't have enough of that psychological energy that was free, which could deal with this and think about it. Any element of hope. Well, in a certain sense then, that even though that's bad, but nevertheless it was necessary. So that the miracle that would take place would be that much more impressive. But here too, Moshe meets with failure. Interestingly though, take a look at Moshe's reaction. Then God says to Moshe again. We have a series. We're now in chapter 6, verse 10. A series of messages to Moshe. Things seem to be picking up. God said to Moshe, go and speak to Paro, king of Egypt, that he should send forth Bnei Yisrael Me'arta, the Jews from his land. So whatever Moshe is doing, we see two perspectives. That what he's doing is not succeeding, and God's sending him on further missions. So Moshe responds before God and said, behold, the Bnei Yisrael did not listen to me. Now how should Paro listen to me? And I am of uncircumcised lips. This is called the Kal Vachomer. It's a principle of logic. Sort of from the major to the minor. I'm not sure about the exact of the formal. In other words, that if it's a valid form of reasoning, if the Jews, who one would expect would listen to me for all the various reasons, for them it's a message of deliverance and so on and so forth, and I'm Jewish and all. If they rejected me, how much more so Paro? How's Paro supposed to listen? He's my enemy. He's the king. He doesn't want to hear this message. But Moshe adds an additional thing to it. And one could raise a question. What does one thing have? Then he says, and I have a speech impediment, uncircumcised lips. So why does he have to mention that as well? Maybe he's strengthening the argument. Perhaps he's strengthening the argument. That even if it's not a good logical inference, that the fact that the Jews rejected me automatically means that Paro will reject me. So then he mentions the other element. The problem that I have over here, see, because part of our task is just to analyze, to raise the proper questions. What question comes to mind on this when you read this? When I read this verse, I had a question. Something bothered me. What bothers me when I read this pasuk is, why is Moshe still complaining about the speech impediment? Wasn't the issue taken up already? That was the issue that he raised at the burning bush. And as we said, at first God wanted him to go by himself with the speech impediment, and God said, I'll tell you what to say. You'll be successful. But Moshe pleaded with him. He didn't want to go that way. And God said, okay. God got angry with him, but he said, I'll appoint Aaron, your brother. He can speak. He'll be your spokesman. So as we said, originally Aaron was not supposed to be part of the mission. But due to Moshe's reluctance and praying and whatever it was, God now adds on Aaron to help him. If that's the case, my understanding is, so Aaron is going to be doing the speaking, so why is Moshe still complaining that he's uncircumcised lips?
Yeah, why?
That shouldn't be the issue anymore. That should merely be the only issue might be the first argument, that how can you expect Paro to listen to me if the Jews don't listen to me? But the additional factor of uncircumcised lips, how do we account for that, given that Aaron is part of the picture already? The Ramban helps us to resolve this. Because he says that when Moshe went to Paro, it's not a simplistic thing. As we at first might think, that God appointed the Aaron, and that means to say that Moshe won't do any talking anymore. It's not that simple. It means that he'll have a helper. On certain occasions, Aaron will speak at this point in time. But the Ramban explains that basically the role of Aaron was to the Jews, in explaining to the Jews. But when they went to Paro, Moshe was supposed to speak to Paro, because it would appear disrespectful. See, everything has to operate in accordance with the ordinary laws of nature, unless God performs a specific miracle. Other than that, everything works. And in order to be successful, you have to make the right moves. So the right move was for Moshe to speak, because it might be perceived as haughtiness or disrespect to Paro. And that's the case. If you have a meeting with someone who's so important that you can't even speak directly to him, and you can only speak to him through intermediaries, so then that's a sign that this person is on a higher level. Now, if Paro was speaking, and the other side, the Jewish side, well, we have Moshe and we have Aaron, and you can't speak directly to Moshe. Moshe will not speak directly. That would be offensive to Paro. That is to say that the Ramban learns that in the first meeting with Paro, Moshe did the talking. And that would make sense. See, this would make sense over here. So now you're sending me, let's just follow the flow. Now Moshe's arguing, now I failed. I failed with the Jews. They rejected the message. Now Moshe didn't know the reason. It had nothing to do with him. The Pasuk is telling you that the real reason was because of their state of mind. That they were not in the appropriate state of mind at the time. Their spirit was not open to accepting that. No, they couldn't accept such a message at that point in time. It wasn't the fault of Moshe. But Moshe didn't know that. So Moshe took the blame himself. And he says, now you're sending me the power. How will power listen to me? And in addition, we have this other factor that I have the speech impediment. And that makes sense according to Ramban, because it's your will that I should speak to Paro. Because I have to demonstrate respect. Now, in response to that, God said to go to 13, and God said to Moshe and Aaron, God spoke to them and commanded them unto the children of Israel and unto Paro, Melech Mitzrayim. That would be a very, very hard verse to translate. What do you mean, commanded them unto? Commanded them unto Paro, commanded them unto the Bnei Israel. Well, to make a long story short, it means that he charged them now, officially appointed them, officially designated them in their role as being the spokesman, being God's spokesman to the Bnei Israel and to Paro. Now, what's new over here is that at this point in time, God is giving permission for Aaron to do the talking to Paro. And this would be a response to Moshe. Because Moshe was saying that there's no way I could be successful in talking to Paro because you have not given permission for Aaron to speak to Paro. Because the reason being, it would be disrespectful. I have to speak to him. And I failed and I don't have a speech impediment. So if I'm going to go back to Paro, it's just going to be worse. So at this point in time, God changes the rules and commands both of them to the Bnei Israel, to the Jews, and to Paro. Just a side point before we go on, just to tie up a loose end, the message that I said we could learn, because we're always looking for practical benefits that even if it's not the direct meaning of the pasuk, we can deduce it anyway sometimes, is that you should factor that in. Whenever you're going to present somebody with ideas that you might have to convince them, they're not readily necessarily about to accept, it's going to be complicated. You're going to have to convince somebody to try something in any context you want. Bear in mind, of course you try and bear in mind who the person is, the capacity of that person to consider these types of ideas, the state of mind of the person. And that, of course, you have to think of how am I going to present these ideas to the person. Sometimes you just have one way of presenting something. If you heard something and it makes perfect sense because your mind operates in a certain logical way. So very often you assume, I'll just say it over the way I heard it. It's so clear. And you do that and then you're disappointed. To what seems so clear to you, the other person thinks you're crazy. And therefore, there could be many factors, obviously. First of all, it could be that this person is not even open to these types of notions. Also, maybe they are, but you've got them at the wrong time. The state of mind of the person at the time. Timing is an important thing. A lot of times you meet with failure because you chose the wrong time to present something. The person was just not, wasn't the right time, wasn't in the right frame of mind, and never really even listened to you. So that's an important thing. But also try and get familiar with how this person thinks. And very often what's appealing to you is distasteful to others. So you try and work it in with their how they think. And if you can present somebody with something that within his categories of thinking, how it makes sense in his categories of thinking, that gives you a certain opening, then maybe you can get the idea across. Then you have the digression of the names. Going back now to the parasha, chapter 6, from 14, you have the digression, giving you the lineage of Moshe and Aaron. That is right before they embark on the mission. Now the mission really begins in earnest. So the Torah sort of gives you the background, the lineage of Moshe and Aaron. All right, we're not going to take that up right now. The reason why I think that even though originally Moshe was supposed to speak to Paro because it would be disrespectful otherwise, but that now it's okay, because I think that's the way these things work. That originally, when you first go to him, you have to show respect. But once that's established, and there's going to be ongoing negotiations, so then he can understand it. That the fact that you're having Aaron speak for you is not because you don't respect Paro, it's because it's more effective. So, it's just, but in the initial meeting, that's where you have to demonstrate the protocol. Wow. Now you go to chapter 7. From there till the end of the chapter is concerned mainly with what we said, to establish the background, the genealogy of Moshe and Aaron. Now you have verse 7, the narrative continues. God said to Moshe, "See, I have made you as a god unto Paro, and Aaron, your brother, will be your prophet." So this is the result of the new arrangement. This is the way they're going to be conducting the talks. That you will speak, you will say everything that I command you. God will communicate with Moshe. And Aaron, your brother, will speak to Paro, that he should send forth the Jews from his land. So that's the way it's going to be. Moshe will receive the prophecy. He'll give it over to Aaron. Aaron will then communicate it to Paro. Now, what comes next is really a bombshell. And I will harden the heart of Paro. And I will increase my signs and wonders in the land of Egypt. What's difficult, of course, in all of the commentaries, raise the question about the idea that God will, what does that mean, that God will harden his heart? What does that mean? And verse 4 seems to get the answer. And Paro will not listen to you. Why won't he listen to you? It would seem because God has hardened his heart. And I will stretch forth my hand against Egypt, and I will bring forth my hosts, my nation, Bnei Yisrael, from the land of Egypt, with great judgments. Now, this is crucial, this message. And Egypt will know that I am the Lord. Egypt will know. So it's clear that part of the objective, and this is a basic point of Judaism, that it's God's will that all of mankind should recognize him. It's not just the Jews. The Jews have been singled out for a mission, but the objective is for all of mankind to know. And Egypt will know that I am the Lord when I stretch forth my hand over Egypt, and I take forth the Bnei Israel from amongst them. Then it goes on to say that the Moshe and Aaron did as God commanded them. That's what they did. Generally speaking, when the Torah says that, makes a point that Moshe and Aaron did what God commanded, so you'll say, well, of course, what as opposed to what? They did something else? That might seem, superficially, it might seem superfluous, because we know that they did what God commanded. But the Sforno makes an important comment, and you'll see this, Rashi makes the same point in many places. You'll find that in the construction of the tabernacle, the Mishkan in the wilderness, that point being repeated many times, after God commands them, that the saying that they did as God commanded. And you wonder, well, of course, as opposed to what? So the Sforno adds the words, lo hosifu, they didn't add, velo goru, and they didn't detract. And Rashi makes the point many times, it comes to teach us that they did not make any kind of changes, but they did it exactly as God commanded them. Of course, the question is, again, so wouldn't we assume that? What is it telling us? Why would I? What do I have a need to know a thing like that when it seems to be pretty obvious? Well, I mean, part of the answer is that we're talking, again, we see that these are human beings. We tend to look at these kinds of people as though they were not ordinary humans. Well, in many senses, obviously. That's a big demand that the Torah makes upon us. That on the one hand, we really have to recognize the fact that there are superior people, and we have to adapt the correct attitude towards genuinely superior people. A certain attitude of awe and respect. But of course, we have to be very, very careful not to go beyond the boundary line and to allow ourselves to believe that they're more than human beings. Obviously, we can't assume that the level that we're at is the highest level. We have to be capable of being humble and recognizing that there are human beings who are on a higher plane than we are, but they're still human beings. So you have to avoid either extreme. But even Moshe and Aaron, when you're charged with a tremendous mission and you have certain guidelines, you get involved in it, you want that it should succeed. I mean, there's many factors that come into the picture. Many factors. You want it to succeed. You don't want it to fail. So both emotions. Sometimes you want to make some changes. If I could just do it, you feel that if I did it differently. You see that even with rabbis today, with this pressure from people and so forth, and you feel if you could make some changes, then you'd be more effective in terms of the mission to win the people over, that the people should keep the Torah and so forth. These situations are very, very tempting. Nobody wants to be a failure. Or sometimes you feel that it's wrong, something is being done that's wrong, but if you complain about it at this point in time, it won't be effective. So you sort of have this desire to hold back. There's always going to be that situation. A certain tension between what God is commanding and the way it appears to us. Our vision is limited. So it's telling you something about the greatness. That when they carried out the instructions of God, they were faithful servants. They did not inject their own way of looking at it, in spite of the fact that very often their own way might have been different.
Can I ask you something?
Getting back to the question of hardening of the heart, which seems to mean an invasion, that God will invade the private territory of Paro's mind. That's what it seems to mean. I'm going to harden his heart, make him stubborn, and he's going to refuse. So it seems to be that God is predetermining what's going to happen. That Paro will not have the opportunity or the freedom to go along with it. So this raises, if that is the case, it raises many questions. Well, what's the most obvious question that it raises? If you're saying that this means that God took away Paro's freedom, his free choice, this raises many questions, because that's the will of God, that man should have free will. And even if you say, well, he was a sinner, but that's, we don't believe that sin, even a sinner, is predisposed towards death and destruction. We don't believe that. That is to say, he still has the opportunity. Man has a number of opportunities. Well, originally, you should choose the right path. But that if a person chooses the wrong path, so now we have the concept of tshuva, of, so to speak, repentance, return. And it seems to be exceedingly generous, the policy. Because it seems that a person never runs out of chances. And there's many statements in the prophets that God only desires that the sinner should repent and return, and that if he does so, he'll be forgiven. Of course, if it's sincere is the word. And the Rambam goes so far as to say that there is no sin of all the sins, the worst possible sin, is not outside of the possibility of repentance. That is to say, even if a person was a sinner all of his days, and he only repents at the end, and even if he just repents on his deathbed, so he's forgiven, if it's sincere. He's forgiven. And he has a share in the world to come. That's a famous fundamental concept of Judaism. And it would thus seem, from my reading of the Rambam, that you name it, whatever names come to mind on your short list of, you know, wicked Hall of Famers. Who's the 10 most wicked? Who are the 10 most wicked people in history? Why would God take away his free will? If he has free will, there's a possibility that he could do tshuva. And indeed, that seems to be what God desires. To the contrary, you see the opposite. Where do you see an opposite, quote unquote, approach or attitude, whatever? I don't want to use words like that and apply them to God. But where do you see God pushing in the opposite direction? There's a certain irony in another book of the Bible called Yonah. God sends his prophet to the wicked city of Nineveh. Exceedingly, exceedingly wicked, and they were earmarked for destruction. To the extent that Yonah didn't want to go. He seeks to escape the mission. It bothered him greatly. That's the whole subject matter of the book. We read it on the afternoon of Yom Kippur. The message over there that God forced him to go. Interesting, if one could make a comparison between Moshe's reluctance to go, and Yonah's reluctance to go. It wasn't for the same reasons. Clearly, Yonah was exasperated with the very notion that these people would not be destroyed for something which he couldn't tolerate. And there, God communicates with him, and there's the whole story about the gourd that provided shade for Yonah, and then God removes it, and the dialogue. Strange dialogue. But the basic idea seems to be, in general terms, that God is telling him that you don't understand my mercies. You can't understand me. Nor can you understand my mercies. So there's an element of divine, quote-unquote, compassion, even for the wicked. And God gives them a chance to do tshuva. And guess what? They took it. They did tshuva. That's clearly one of the most amazing stories. The most amazing thing to me is that they actually changed on the brink. Where do you see any? I've never seen a case where a society is able to change, let alone an individual perhaps, but a society entrenched in a certain way of life, heading towards destruction, and they're able to stop themselves in their path and to listen to a prophet of God and to fast and don sackcloth and to change and to be worthy of redemption. It's hard for me to think of any case in history. So the question is, what does this mean? Does it mean that God took away Paro's free will, which would be a major, major issue? It's God's will that the man should have free will. However, the question goes further. If that is the case, so what about the justice? In the sense that as Paro refuses, so God increases the pain. And it seems that he's going to be punished. That is, Moshe is always presenting him with the challenge, you know, let my people go, and if you let them go. If not, such and such will happen. But if Paro doesn't have the freedom of will, so why is he deserving? Why should he be punished? Of course, if he had free will, and in spite of everything, he persists, so then we understand it. But how are we to understand what takes place if God is telling him at the outset? It's one thing if God says that he won't listen. That's a different issue. That doesn't mean he doesn't have free will. That's a sign that God knows what a person is going to do. And that's a separate issue. How can God know what a person is going to do and a person still has freedom? Once God knows, doesn't that mean that the person has to do that? Because God couldn't be wrong. That's a different issue. The Rambam talks about that. We're not taking that up at this point. And the Rambam resolves that issue. That the fact that God knows how a person is going to use their free will doesn't mean the person doesn't have free will. God is not the cause of what you do. You are the cause of what you do. But that's known to God. That we're not asking. Had God merely told Moshe that Paro is not going to listen to you, okay, then we wouldn't have any question. However, the difficulty is that God says, I'm going to harden his heart, which seems to mean I'm going to prevent him. And if that's what it means, so then it raises all kinds of questions. And there are three questions. First of all, why? When the essence of Judaism is all about free will, and even for the sinner. And God waits, so to speak, for the sinner. And God gives him every chance. Indeed, that was the story of Jonah and Nineveh. The second issue is, if he doesn't have free will, so then we have a problem in terms of the justice. So why does he deserve to be punished for refusing to do something which, it turns out, he couldn't really do at all? Indeed, the Rambam, one of his proofs that the Torah maintains his free will, is from the fact that we have commandments and prohibitions in the Torah. And he's saying, how could God command us? How could you have commandments and prohibitions? How could you have rewards and punishments if it turns out that man has no choice? Whatever he does is determined anyway. So if you maintain that the Torah is true, then you have to maintain that man has free will. And therefore, he can be commanded. He can be prohibited. If he conforms to performs what's commanded, so he deserves to be rewarded. If he violates what he's been prohibited, so then he deserves to be punished. All this makes sense. That's the second issue. But here, how could it be that Paro, the Rambam has already said that if a person didn't have free will, then it wouldn't be just that he should be punished because he didn't do anything wrong. He just acted his nature. Yet Paro, it seems, is going to be punished. Is punished. Even though, if we take that to mean the hardening of the heart, means that he didn't have free will. And I'd just like to add a third question, and that is, what's the point? What would be the point of Moshe going through the motions? The whole thing, see, that Moshe is concerned, how will Paro listen to me? It doesn't make any sense. I'm not a good... he's not going to listen to anyone. He's not going to listen because he can't listen. So why go through the motions? Why go through the motions? Is that what it means? That every time Moshe went, it was just going through the motions. That he's threatening Paro and so on. But Paro couldn't agree. So then why do this even? Punish him if that's what you want. Whatever you want to do, do. But I mean, what's the point of going through? It's a charade. Is this a charade? The outcome, it's all fixed. It's like fixed, so to speak. It's not really happening. In reality, he's going and he's telling him, but you're talking to a person that doesn't have the ability to say yes. So then why do it? What's the point? As you read the story, the incident, it seems that it's real, and Moshe is trying, and sometimes he reaches him and he calls him back, and they have to say, all right, it's true that he didn't. As we see, Paro did not let them go until the 10th plague. I'll add another question. I'll just add another question, and I'm not sure, I haven't seen this question anywheres. If the point is that God will harden his heart, and that means that he will not have the free will in this area, that he will not have the capacity to make a decision to let you go, so then how do we understand the fact that God did let, excuse me, that Paro did let them go as a result of the 10th plague? That night, the night of the 10th plague, then Paro did let them go. In fact, according to Rashi, Paro himself, not through messengers, he came searching for Moshe to inform him, and in fact, he wanted him to leave immediately. Then why he wanted him to leave immediately? And Moshe said, we'll go in the morning. We're not going to leave until the morning. So how do we understand that? If Paro did not have the free will to make a decision to let the Jews go, and indeed, that's why for the first nine, he kept saying no, so then how do we understand what happened with the 10th? Did God give him back his free will? That seems to be difficult. So those are the questions that we want to take up in our next session. clear, not everybody will interpret the hardening of the heart that way. That's our task, to understand it. But there are different viewpoints. One of them is the viewpoint of the Rambam, the big exponent, the chief exponent of free will, who nevertheless holds that this is what it means over here, that God is saying he will take away his free will.